I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Jolene Greenwood has an identical twin, and she couldn't be happier about it. Not only do they share genes, but a lifetime of experiences together. She's used her own life to understand what it means to have an identical twin from childhood to adulthood to old age, from identity to dating and marriage. Jolene Greenwood is a family sociologist at Kutztown University in Pennsylvania, and she sat down with Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler to talk about her research findings that she conducted at the Twins Days Festival in Twinsburg, Ohio this summer, also why she loves being a twin. Liz will be live tweeting during the interview, so join the conversation at WHYY Radio Times. That's at WHYY Radio Times. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let's listen.
Jolene Greenwood, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get interested in studying twins? I imagine, I'm just guessing here, that it had something to do with the fact that you yourself are a twin.
It absolutely had something to do with being a twin myself. I am an identical twin, and for a number of years I was in graduate school and finishing up, and I had a different dissertation topic that was related to divorce and effect on family relationships, but I've always wanted to research identical twins, particularly the twin-sibling relationship, and not fraternal twins, but identical twins, because my experience has been phenomenal. I love being an identical twin, and now I am data-driven, and as a social scientist, I basically just wanted to see if other identical twins felt the same way that I did and that my sister did.
And you mentioned that there's a dearth of research on identical twins. I find that surprising because it seems like such a fascinating area to study. Did you also, were you surprised that there wasn't more research on it?
I was surprised, and specifically there's not a whole lot of research on the social relationship, specifically looking at that identical twin sibling relationship. Now, if you Google identical twins research, there is a ton of research on identical twins, specifically teasing out the nature versus nurture issues, of course. But I was very surprised. People have been more than enthusiastic to participate in the study. They're excited about it, which is cool.
And your identical twin's name is Nikki. Tell me, what's Nikki like? Are you similar? Were you the sort of identical twins who people often confused? I thought you were Nikki. Tell me what that was like growing up and also now, what it's like.
Yeah, absolutely. These are similar questions that I ask my interviewees. So it was fabulous. But then again, it's all I ever knew. And it's one of the things that when somebody says, what is it like being a twin, or what's it like being an identical twin? I say, my first response is, it's great. It's just like having a built-in best friend, a built-in playmate. But the other answer is, it's all I ever know. But it's always been wonderful. We were always referred to as the twins by family members, friends, the girls. My older brother always called us the girls. It was a wonderful experience. We were close all throughout. We definitely looked alike up until, I'd say, maybe age 12, 13, about adolescence. And then we started looking more dissimilar. And now we don't really look like identical twins. In certain pictures we do, but not nearly as identical as some of the twins that we came across at the Twins Days Festival. But it's interesting because we always, we're always defending, no, we really are identical twins. We look a little different now, but it's been amazing. And you go through life together. You constantly have support. You know how the other one's thinking, feeling.
And you mentioned that when you were a kid, you and your sister were referred to as the twins. I heard a story I want to ask you about really quickly before we delve into your research. It was that there was a pair of twins when they were children. They go to a friend's party and there are a bunch of other kids. And the mom would give each child a cookie and then broke the cookie in half and gave each of the twins one half. I wonder if you ever had an experience like that where, as a kid, you and Nikki were seen as the twins, not individual people per se, but part of a whole.
Well, absolutely. I think a great example would be, of course, we shared the same birthday, and we got gifts to share. right? Unfortunately.
Just what every child wants.
Just what every child wants, right? You have to share with your brother. You have to share with your sister. So we always got gifts to share. And those joint gifts, you share a birthday cake, right? But my mother always treated us equally. And it was always, you know, if something is being divided, it has to be perfectly equal, right? So one half to the other. So, you know, splitting the cookie in half as, okay, well, there's one and we'll split it between the two because that's what we do with everything is very typical. Yeah.
So I understand to conduct your research, you took a trip to the Twins Day Festival located in Twinsburg, Ohio, held every August. Before doing some reading for this interview, I have to admit I'd never heard of it, but I imagine growing up as a twin in Western Pennsylvania, you probably had at least heard of it. Tell me about that and what it was like to attend.
I had always heard of it. In particular, my mother always, she knew about it and she'd say, oh, we should do that sometime. And we never did. And so I had started this particular research project back in November 2013 through the spring of 2014, interviewing about 40 identical twins. And I wanted to continue the research because I wanted a larger sample size, and I was able to figure out some common themes and places where I could get a larger sample and more diverse, et cetera. And so in the initial part of the study back in 2013-14, I'd used Craigslist and Facebook and other social media, which worked. But then I thought, well, I'd like an additional, say, 80. And then all of a sudden, I thought the Twins Days Festival. And so I was on the website, and I actually saw that they have research booths set up. And you have access to thousands of twins, identical twins.
You mentioned there are other sorts of research being done there as well. I found it really fascinating. There's all sorts of DNA, genetic testing, facial recognition, looking at twins. I mean, such a rich area to study with so many subjects there.
It was wonderful. And my sister and I actually got to take part in some of those research studies as well. So early in the morning when we had a little time or toward the evening, we'd go over and participate in some of those studies, which was fun getting to do that as well.
So your goal at the Twins Day Festival was to get, you said, about 80 identical twins to sign up to sit for these 30-minute interviews. Was it hard to get them to agree to do it?
Absolutely not. Saturday morning was the opening day of the festival for the public. Parade was at 9 a.m. And the twins and their family members started filtering in about 10 a.m. By 12:30 that afternoon, a mere 2.5 hours later, we had maxed out. I ran out of paperwork, and I had 120 individuals interested. So it was fantastic. So I was pleasantly surprised, a little overwhelmed. upon reflection, I was trying to think, well, I wonder why they really wanted to do it, but really out of the different research schools, universities, hospitals there, a lot of it was genetic and, you know, you're spitting into a tube or you're doing facial recognition. And here with us, they get to talk about being a twin, right? Something that I would say the majority of them loved. That's why they were there, right? So there's probably a bias with the twins who attended the Twins Day Festival because they tend to be really into their twinness.
And what did you hope to learn from these twins? What did you ask them? Give me an idea of some of the questions, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask them a number of things. Primarily, the title of my research is The Identical Twin-Sibling Relationship, Not Your Ordinary Sibling Bond. So one of the main questions I'm interested in is the identical twin-sibling relationship similar to or different from an ordinary sibling relationship? I was also interested in if being an identical twin affects intimate relationships with dating partners, spouses, right? And also other relationships, does it affect your relationship with other siblings, older siblings, younger siblings? And last, I wanted to see if being an identical twin affected other social relationships, such as your friendships during childhood, adolescence, and even adulthood. And I think I gathered some really good data.
And so the study that you're doing now, you said it builds on these twin interviews that you already did back in 2013, 2014. I wonder if anything that you've heard, in particular from the recent interviews, anything you've heard has surprised you?
I wouldn't say anything necessarily surprised me. What I had heard during the initial 40 interviews, and I've heard a few times with the interviews that at least I conducted most recently, is this concern about mortality and losing the other twin. And I think why I'm surprised by it is it's something that I personally haven't thought about. And a lot of my research questions are based on my own personal experience. And so at the age of 37, it's not really something that's on my mind right now. But in interviewing older individuals, say late 60s, and it's something they talked about. And it's something that's a real concern for them, even issues with getting older and health issues and not being able to get around so much. So I was surprised by that, but I think it's really an important issue to consider.
In an interview you did, I think it was in Vox, you talked about these twins and them really expressing this real concern about the loss of the other twin because, as was pointed out, these are people born on the same day but unlikely to die on the same day, and that this pain, this idea of this loss is greater than us non-twins can imagine, that it's mm-hmm. different than the death of a sibling in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's identical twins indicate that, you know, it's just I can't even think about it. So ones who even started to talk about it, they just say, I can't even bear the thought of it. I can't even think about losing him or her first. I just can't even talk about it. Other research does indicate that losing an identical twin, the grief associated with that is very similar to losing a spouse. And so really getting at the intimacy associated with that relationship.
And moving on a little bit through the life cycle, did you find any indication that being an identical twin affects social relationships? Do people have more friends, fewer friends?
I think overall, and there's a question on the interview guide where we ask, do you feel that being an identical twin affects the number and quality of your friendships? You know, and I ask other follow-up questions such as, would you say you had a lot of friends? Do you have a lot of friends currently? And I worry about the social desirability bias when I ask that question because people want to say, oh, sure, I have a lot of friends. But they'll say, a lot of people will say, yes, I'm social, I have a lot of acquaintances. But one theme that is emerging is that identical twins, I'd say about at least one half of the individuals we interviewed would say something to the effect of, I don't have a whole lot of very close friends. And a lot of it has to do with their best friend is still their identical twin. And so they'll say, I have a lot of acquaintances, I have a lot of friendships, I have a lot of people I hang out with, but I don't have a whole lot of really close relationships. Some identical twins even said something to the effect of, you know, well, in terms of friendships and being a best friend, my twin sister, twin brother has set the bar really high, and it's really hard to find somebody that has that level of trust and support for you.
We're listening to Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler's interview with Jolene Greenwood, a family sociologist at Kutztown University. Liz is live tweeting during this interview. You can join the conversation at WHYY Radio Times. More on being a twin from childhood through old age after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And we're listening to producer Elizabeth Fiedler's interview with Jolene Greenwood. She's a family sociologist at Kutztown University. They're discussing Greenwood's research into identical twins and whether we singletons should be jealous that we don't have a twin, too.
As you mentioned, the folks who showed up to the Twins Days Festival, is this sort of a self-selected group. These are people who already feel a bond with their twin. There's no doubt a lot of twins out there, even identical twins, who do not feel that way or at least don't feel it so strongly, right?
And I'm actually glad you brought that up. It's something I was thinking about lately. While we make generalizations and pull out these themes from the data we collect and what the, you know, from the stories that the identical twins tell us, there are those identical twins who say, we're close. But they realize that they're not as close as other identical twins. And it's interesting because they're almost apologetic about it. They're trying to meet society's expectations that, oh, identical twins, you're all best friends and everything is great and you don't get mad at one another. But reality is there are going to be those ones who they're not as close for various reasons.
And does being an identical twin in your research seem to affect romantic relationships? Let's talk about that.
It's an interesting question, right? Yes and no is the answer to that. I would say about 10% of the participants indicated that it negatively affected intimate relationships, whether it was with a dating partner or a spouse, where there's a bit of jealousy on the part of the spouse being jealous of that twin relationship, that closeness, you know, not being able to get through that closeness. Another issue is the time component. You know, sometimes identical twins, the relationship is so close that it takes up a lot of time, whether they're on the phone or if they live in close proximity, maybe spending a lot of time with one another, spouse can feel neglected. That's about 10% of relationships. Now, since I was interested in the evolution of their relationship over time, something that did stand out is during when identical twins, when one of them would get their first boyfriend or girlfriend, this is a time that it put a strain on their relationship for, I'd say probably 25% of them indicated, and that's just a guess, that it was rough. It put a strain on the relationship. You go from spending the majority of your time with somebody, being emotionally close, and just being with one another almost all of the time, and now the other twin has a boyfriend, girlfriend, takes time away. That put a strain on the relationship for those who talked about it negatively affecting them.
And did you talk to any of these twins about a little later in their life cycle once they got married, whether having a husband or a wife was difficult for their identical twin? Did they feel like they were playing sort of second fiddle in that relationship?
That's exactly the phrase that I had heard. And one gentleman was talking about when he first got married and his wife just felt like she was, you know, second fiddle. And it was tough for a while. But he said over time, it got better and seemed to be okay. They were still married.
I know a lot of times people outside of the sphere of twins use language like the other half or referring to twins as the twins. I know a mom of twins who requested that people not refer to them as the twins. Did language come up at all? The power of linguistics?
Yeah, absolutely. It did. You know, even I personally, we were referred to as the twins. I mean, up until I think my grandparents were still saying the twins, you know. Certainly being referred to as the twins. Even the identical twins themselves, when they would be talking about things, it was really interesting that I was picking up on and my twin sister was picking up on too. They said we a lot. That it was really, I mean, that identity is not just that self-identity, but it is that twin identity. And in talking about things, we, some of them would correct themselves when they'd be talking about something, we, and then say, oh, well, I, really interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I noticed, but absolutely. And I, being referred to as the twins, I think it's, you know, the novelty of being twins, and a lot of people can't get past that twinness.
And let's talk about the concept of the shared friend, because I find it really fascinating. What is the shared friend and why is it so common among twins?
The shared friend is the, the other best friend that a lot of times it's a triad. And so you have three. So you have the identical twins and then you have this sort of outsider who is in that little group, that triad. Very common among identical twins. In some cases, there are maybe, you know, maybe there are two of them, you know, two other friends, but it's this common group of, like, almost like best friends. So it's that triad. Triads can work in one of two ways, right? So a triad, that third person who would be sort of the outsider, it could be the two against one, right? So, you know, we get mad at the other one and, you know, the twins stick together, blood is thicker than water. But it can also work the other way where sort of working out any problems, any conflicts that the third, right, that other friend, the non-twin, can really serve as a mediator if there's something going on. Now, in response to your other question, did my sister and I have a shared friend? We absolutely did. It's my shout out to Crystal. And it's interesting because we were best friends from middle school all through high school. And Crystal was a year behind us. So my sister and I went off to college, the same college, of course, the same major, right? And we kind of grew apart from Christo. That we there was certainly a period of time where we didn't talk for a number of years. And back in, I want to say, 2009, we all got together again, you know, as young adults already having experienced college. And then just a few weeks ago, we got together again after, I want to say, it had been maybe 5 years for me not seeing Crystal, and it had been about 6 or 7 that we all had not been together. And it was wonderful being together again. Number one, like, no time had passed. But it was the same weekend that I had just returned, or my sister and I had just returned from Twins Days, right? So this was fresh on my mind, and I wanted to say, well, how did you feel? You know, I was asking other identical twins, how did you feel? I said, did you ever feel like you weren't as close to us? Or did you ever feel threatened by that triad, that it was two against one? And she said no. And in fact, there are very, very few times that we actually fought. Now, we were best friends middle school all through high school, so we're talking six, seven years. And, you know, she said, oh, I think there was one time that Nikki got mad at me for something, but, you know, it was like a day or something like that. And I think that's really remarkable. It's been a lot of fun talking with other identical twins because it's the bond is so unique. I know what it's like from personal experience. And really getting the data and hearing other twins' stories and perspectives and just seeing if I relate or my experience is similar to or different from theirs has been really, really interesting.
It must have been so amazing for you and Nikki to be there at the Twins Days Festival surrounded by other twins. Unlike out here in our world, no one there would say, oh my gosh, you're a twin.
Or I didn't know you had a twin. Or wow, this is your twin. And no, I mean, you felt unique, but you didn't feel as unique there with everybody else who had somebody by their side as well.
And I know plenty of siblings, not twins, but siblings who are in the same sport, right? They're both in tennis, they're both in soccer, and are hyper-competitive. They want to be the best one in the family at that thing, whatever it is. Does that happen with twins?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially sports. And the competition, there's parents, and not just parents, but coaches and others really, I think, encourage that competition. And it's tough. And I asked the identical twins to talk about what are some negatives associated with being an identical twin. And so many of them said the competition or constantly being compared to the other twin.
And let's talk a little bit about how twins over their life cycle develop their identity. And this idea, I understand, it's pretty common of parents separating twins intentionally, either in school or in activities, helping the twins, I guess, effectively build their identity and sense of self and talents and abilities and even friend groups. Talk to me about that and what came out in your research.
Yeah, so I do ask about, I ask the identical twins to talk about their relationship over time, so especially during childhood and adolescence. Something that was very common, something that came up quite often, is they would talk about their school experience and whether or not they were separated in grade school. Sometimes it was intentional. Sometimes the parents wanted it. Sometimes the schools, that's actually a policy that they will separate them. And the idea is to help, as you mentioned, for the identical twins to establish that, you know, self-identity, right? Apart from being a twin, a lot of them really talked about how it was a difficult time, that they wanted to be together, that this was something forced on them. My sister and I had a similar experience. And when we went to public school in third grade, we were separated.
Did this come out in your research at all? People talking about maybe the guilt that their parents felt when they heard, I didn't do a perfect job.
Yeah, my mother and my father also did a very good job about never... They would never compare us. They always say, you're equal, right? You're equal, and no, you're not better. I can't answer that. And even my sister and I just experienced, my mother just passed away about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we were taking care of my mother during her last couple weeks. And we were the primary caregivers, and my sister and I were all of a sudden put in this position where we're taking care of my mother. And we're her nurses, and we're administering medications and things like that. And my sister would always joke around with my mom, and she'd put her arm around my mom, and she'd say, Mom, who's the better nurse, Jolene's not here. She's not listening. You can say it, Mom. And even my mom, until her dying day, she would shake her head and say no. She wouldn't answer it, and she'd say equal. So really, my mom always said that we were equal, and she wouldn't answer it. She would never compare us. Others, more likely to compare us, you know, say, oh, well, you're a little bigger than her, or something like that. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh, you know, and I'd feel, you know, I'd say, oh, you shouldn't say that. But people are very, 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 very quick to compare identical twins, pointing out little differences that typical siblings, you're not pointing out differences, right? So, even the identical twins, they, in my research, said about the same, that parents did try to treat them equally, didn't necessarily compare them, you know, oh, here's the smarter one and not so smart. Or, you know, sometimes they'd say things like, oh, well, it would be more about the activities they were in. Or, you know, oh, this one was more athletic just because they were more involved in sports and the other one was involved in, you know, whatever it may be, you know, drama or whatever. But I know at least my parents tried very, very hard not to compare us and to have others not compare us as well.
I'm sorry for your mom's passing. I wonder if it helped you, how much it helped you to have your twin there and to have her help you in the grieving process, as any sibling would, but maybe even more closely understanding what you were going through.
Yeah, you know, I think we have that bond, and even it really worked out emotionally and just being there and just getting the day-to-day, the hour-to-hour, the minute-to-minute task that needed done and caring for my mother, because we knew what needed done. There was a time where my sister got pretty stern with me and, you know, she said, this needs to be done now. And I didn't get upset with her, and I talked about it, and, you know, I pulled her aside into the kitchen and I said, listen, you've got to get it together. And I can do that with my sister, and especially during that time, in a very delicate time, and because we can do that with one another, and maybe other siblings can do that, but certainly during that time, it helped. And just being there for one another, and just kind of knowing that we are going through it together, knowing that our grieving process is the same, and I think a lot of it goes back to our relationship with our parents, and our siblings is very, very similar. So the way I feel about my relationship with my older brother and my kid sister, my sister would describe equally. And that was very common with other identical twins too. Even our relationship with our parents is pretty similar with both my mother and my father. And so I think that helped because we experienced it together, similar to our siblings, but different as well. Yeah, so I think it definitely helped. You have, like I said before, you have somebody who knows your thoughts and you can just sit on the phone with them or sit in the same room and you don't have to talk. We know how to sort of take care of one another in that way that I think perhaps other siblings don't. And it's been very helpful. Yeah.
I understand there's like a twin A and a twin B. Explain that to me. And you mentioned that some of the twins you spoke to, in some cases, they would sort of speak for the pair of twins. Tell me about that and whether it's traditionally like, is one more dominant, or are there generalizations we can make about that?
You know, I think there are generalizations out there. I don't know how accurate they are because I feel like my sister and I are opposite of what the generalization mm-hmm. is. But, you know, the idea that twin A is the more dominant one, the one who speaks on behalf of the twins. Twin B is a little more quiet, reserved.
And twin A would simply be the twin who was born first, I would assume.
Yeah. A lot of the twins that we interviewed really self-identified that way. Oh, well, I'm twin A and she's twin B. And they really embraced that. And it's not something that my sister and I did, so it was interesting to hear those twins talk about it. And I don't know if it comes from, if it's a media thing or if it's a social thing. I'm not really certain about that. It's something I'd actually like to look into a little more.
And an article I read about the Twins Day Festival suggested maybe we would all be happier in the future if we were twins. And we'd be guaranteed to have this partner for life through all of the life cycle. As an identical twin, what do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think I can answer it one of two ways. And if everybody were an identical twin, it would take away the novelty from me, and I wouldn't feel as special and unique, I suppose. But the other part of the answer is it's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it's that social bond that I don't, that's very, very difficult to break. It's not just having a built-in best friend, but knowing that you have somebody to talk to that knows your thoughts or knows how you're feeling, knows how you're thinking. And that's wonderful because sometimes you can just, you call them, right? And there are times, not just that my sister and I do this, but other identical twins talked about this. You call and phone and my sister and I talk, my husband will tell you like 50 times a day, but we talk multiple times a day. Sometimes there's not a whole lot of conversation going on, but you have somebody on the other end of the phone or you're sitting in the same room and you don't have to talk, but you kind of know what each other's thinking. Or if my twin seems to be bothered by something, it's just sort of being there, you know, very similar to other intimate relationships with, say, a spouse or you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it may be. It is a wonderful experience. I think it would be wonderful if everybody else could experience that too, because, and this is not just coming from me, I asked, in my research, I asked the twins, you know, what's the best thing about being a twin? And I'd say, any downfalls? You know, they talk about being compared, et cetera, but no, most of them just said, it's great. It's wonderful. And it's really difficult to explain. It's difficult to articulate. But it's a great relationship. And I think if everybody could experience it, it would be wonderful.
Jolene Greenwood, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That was Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler speaking with family sociologist Jolene Greenwood about her research into identical twins. So would you like to be an identical twin? Go to our Facebook page and let us know. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, I'll be talking with pediatrician Jay Greenspan about the dramatic increase in the number of babies born addicted to opioids in Pennsylvania, what it's like for them to go through withdrawal and the impact on their health, and of course, what to do about the opioid epidemic. That's coming up after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The number of babies born in Pennsylvania addicted to opioids has increased dramatically, 250% in the last 15 years. That's according to the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. These infants require treatment for the symptoms associated with withdrawal and are at risk for prematurity, low birth weight, problems eating, and respiratory distress. Today on the show, why the increase in opioid-addicted infants, what can be done to help them and their mothers. And joining us is Jay Greenspan. He's a professor and chairman at Nemours Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia, where he's pediatrician-in-chief, also chair of the March of Dimes Maternal and Child Health Committee for Pennsylvania. And Jay Greenspan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What does a newborn baby look like or even act like if they are addicted to opioids?
Right. So in general, they're term most of the time. They're normally looking babies, especially for the first couple of days of life. Because they've had dosing from their mom and it takes a little while to show up as a withdrawal symptom. So we watch them for a couple days in the well baby nursery, often bonding with their mom, breastfeeding if possible. But then they start to show signs of withdrawal about three quarters of the time. Not all of them show obvious signs. I think if you really studied them, they all have a little bit going on. But signs are something you'd be predicting normally like an adult would. They're irritable. Difficulty feeding, they're having trouble coordinating themselves, they're stiffer than normal babies in that they're rigid. They may sneeze and cough and breathe fast and the heart rates may be up. We try to prevent having seizures. If you do not treat them, sometimes they can all progress to seizures as well.
I mean, it sounds like they're suffering.
They are, and it's really challenging to watch this, and so we do all we can to help them through it.
As you mentioned, sometimes these symptoms don't show up for a couple of days, and we know for a lot of people, women giving birth, you're in the hospital and 24 hours later, or maybe less, or maybe 36 hours later, you're out the door.
Right.
Does it mean that there are some of these babies are going through withdrawal at home?
Yeah, so we try to prevent that by knowing in advance that the mom is on an opiate. And so if we do know that, we will watch them for longer than a normal baby would be. And so there's some cost to that, but they're in the well baby nursery with the mom. We try to keep the mom there. There are some babies that we catch at home, and that's much more challenging.
Yeah. But because they're at home, they're not there in the hospital getting the kind of care that they need.
Right, so the mom will have to bring them in for some reason.
Is this something that this withdrawal for an infant, is it a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a month? How long does this take?
Yeah, so the problem with withdrawal currently is that you basically have to put them back on opium if you can't use other behavioral techniques to keep them calm. And that takes a long time. So the average length of stay for a baby on pharmacology, so on opiates, is about 30 days.
Wow.
That's a long time.
In
some
the
babies,
hospital.
And often in intensive care because you have to watch them. Sometimes we can get them onto the pediatric floor or some lower cost area so the mom can be with them more. But, you know, they're scary for all of us. We have to watch them closely, certainly for the first couple of days as you're changing their dose.
Is this methadone? Is that what these infants are on, or some form of opiate?
It's an opiate. We use neonatal opium solution, so it's just an opiate. Some places do use actual methadone. There's some movement into getting better drugs for this to addict them less and still keep them safe.
So you're essentially keep lowering the dosage as time goes on so that they can get through the withdrawal from an opiate. What addiction are we talking about? Then infants addicted to opium?
They are addicted. Let's call it what it is. And really what happens is you have to escalate the dose as they start to withdraw to fine-tune where they have to be. And there's some controversy about how much you allow the baby to withdraw naturally because the higher you go, the longer it's going to take. But the next 3 weeks, say, are just weaning them off slowly and making sure they don't have symptoms that you can't control.
You mentioned that many of these babies, or perhaps most of these babies, are full term, so it's not like they're born premature.
Right. So the March of Dimes will say there's some risk of prematurity increase with opiates, but it's really not the main problem. There are other drugs like cocaine that give you risks of prematurity, certainly alcohol and cigarette smoking, and these drugs are really powerful and not to be used. But opiates generally are term babies. Opiate babies are generally term babies that just have – and they're normal
– I was just saying normal weight?
Often normal weight, often well cared for in utero by moms who have been – you know, who found the light and really want to have a healthy child, and they're just struggling with withdrawal, they could have a normal outcome later on. That's the good news.
Well, I wanted to pick up on that because I remember when there was this worry about crack babies, as they were called. This was a couple of decades ago, concern the babies born addicted to crack cocaine would have lifelong problems ahead of them. Is there some version of this that we might be looking at?
Right. So with crack as well as opiates, probably not so much. I mean, actually, if you look at the drugs that are worse for that, it's alcohol and smoking.
Really?
Yeah, alcohol is a really nasty drug for brain development, but opiates don't seem to impact the brain development. These can be normal kids if you put them in a social environment that they'll thrive, and that's what we found with crack was it's more the social environment than the drug itself.
The kind of bonding relationship that develops between child and parent or adult,
right? And that's not easy, right? So you have to work at that, and you have to have a normal family unit, and that's what we found. IQ points dropped when you don't have a normal family unit, and so that there was masking what we thought was we were masking the effect. We thought that it was cocaine, but it was actually just the social environment.
I have to say, you know, reading that a 250% increase in babies in Pennsylvania born addicted to opioids in the last 15 years, that's pretty shocking.
It's really shocking, and it's shocking to all of us. And in fact, I have friends that practice medicine outside of the inner cities like we do in Wilmington and Philadelphia, and they're seeing this. So there's a new population of withdrawing babies, and that's the suburban mom who's been addicted to opiates largely because a provider has prescribed that. And so some of the efforts of the state here and other states is to try to reduce that and to control that. The inner city has gone up too, mainly because these are distressed moms and they're not ones that have been prescribed ever perhaps, but they've gotten on heroin because heroin is so cheap now. So with the increase in the inner city, we believe, is because of the economics, and the suburban increase is due to prescribing.
And does the body know the difference between a pain medication or heroin?
Right. So we don't think so. And you know, there's been some thought, and we may have to revisit this, that, you know, some pain medication is important and it doesn't get addicting. But there's a really fine line between, you know, taking the Percocet for your broken clavicle that you got in a sports injury and then getting off of it at the right time. And, you know, it's incredibly – opiates are incredibly addictive and euphoric drugs. So you get this need sometimes to stay on it. We have to get the word out that it can be really risky to stay on these.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jay Greenspan, and he's professor chair at Nemours Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University, where he is pediatrician in chief, also chair of the March of Dimes Maternal and Child Health Committee for Pennsylvania. We asked him to come on because we read most recently about the numbers of babies born in Pennsylvania addicted to opioids has increased dramatically, about 250% in the last 15 years. Of course, raising a whole host of questions about health and the cost of health and what, of course, can be done for treatment. 1-888-477-9499. Do you know anybody who is in this situation? We'd love to hear from you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You mentioned heroin and drug addiction, and one being a more urban problem, one a more suburban problem. This goes back a couple of years, I guess, this increase prescription for some of these pain medications. And that has led to this then more reliance on things like heroin, which you say is so cheap.
Yeah. So what we think happens is there has been an emphasis on no pain in the hospital and out of the hospital. And maybe we've caused some of this in the medical community. We've certainly seen it in babies. We used to not treat babies. We didn't think they had pain, but we learned that they have pain. And now we treat them frequently. And that may be going on in the adult world as well. So we try to reduce pain. There are probably other ways of doing it that we have to jump up. So mindfulness, things like that, that we found are very effective, and we're doing a lot of work with that at our Mater program in Philadelphia to try to get less addictions to opiates. But the problem in the suburbs is you on the opiate and then you either can't get the drug or it becomes too expensive and then you sort of convert. And unfortunately, it's a really powerful drug that takes one dose perhaps to hook you.
Wow.
And so we just have to understand that, you know, it's not worth a shot.
Well, you mentioned the fact that alcohol and smoking is what is more harmful to a developing fetus than opium?
Well,
or opioids,
rather? For sure. Alcohol, you just can't take when you're pregnant. And we've learned that, and that's a developmental issue. It really impacts the brain. Smoking causes small for gestational age babies and can cause birth defects, and we think that it's more potent as a birth defect creator than opiums. Yeah. But you don't really withdraw from either of those. So it's sort of a different problem in terms of cost. You know, we've looking at the cost of opiates in the nursery since it's gone up so much, and it's really probably approaching $1 billion countrywide. It's a huge cost. It's not the prematurity cost of somewhere around $26 billion, but it's there, and it's unlike prematurity, it's really easy to prevent. You just don't take it. So we need an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure here for sure.
And I'm assuming a mom knows that they shouldn't drink or they shouldn't smoke or use drugs. But, you know, these addictions can be incredibly powerful.
Yeah. And look, I have to say I've talked to some moms. How does this happen to you in the inner city? And it's sort of you know, the pain of trauma that we see with moms, the trauma from in the inner city, it's often abuse or just the horribleness that goes on. And the euphoria you cannot match. And it's
really
just such an attractive.
It feels that good.
And they'll say that to me. They'll say, you know, I knew it was bad for me, but nothing was taking away my pain. And I had my pain every day, you know, from the violence I was experiencing, whatever the trauma was. It's different in the suburbs, for sure. Their trauma might have been a motor vehicle accident. But it's still, once you sense that euphoria, apparently, and, you know, apparently it's incredible that you just are stuck. And so we think getting the word out that, you know, we got to find a way to reduce your traumatic pain in some other way.
I mean, you're describing both psychic and physical pain.
Exactly. And, you know, we know that that psychic pain can cause headaches and belly pain and back pain and all that. We know that in adults as well. But it is a mental pain, a mental distress that is being relieved. It's all being relieved by heroin.
Let me get, looks like Elizabeth from media to join our conversation. And Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering, with the huge costs associated with this problem, if there's any attempt to get the pharmaceutical companies, who are the ones, of course, benefiting from it, to take up any of the slack in the costs.
Do you know?
Well, it's a good question, and that's certainly where the action should be. There has to be some funding because, again, a little bit of money, you know, if you can get a child who's in distress into, you know, a sports camp and get them off of heroin, for instance, that's just an example of where, you know, there's the money spent would more than pay for all the addictions. And so, getting that would be a political move, but I think it's something to consider.
You sent us actually a press release about Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania addressing the legislature about this issue, this opioid epidemic? Is that too strong a word?
It is. It's an epidemic. If you talk to every physician, they'll say it. You know, it's just an epidemic. People are, you know, really distressed by this. And we're very happy the governor stepped up. And this is really a way of just, even at the basic level, knowing if another person has prescribed a medication like an opiate that you should know as a further prescriber. So you can't go from ER to ER and get redosed. And so we know that's a first step. Unfortunately, you know, heroin's still out there, and so if you can't get your dose at your ER, you might seek heroin. But it's a step that we have to take. But to the caller's point, you know, we think that funding to ways of getting less trauma, less trauma and better experiences when you have been traumatized are the way to go.
What do you think is the right kind of treatment for a mom, as you describe, especially dealing with, I'm thinking about the more psychological pains?
Right. So we've actually done some work on that. And you know, mindfulness is really probably where it's at. Just finding ways of, you know, dealing with your trauma in a way that's beneficial to you and to others. Dr. Abeta Marco in our program at Mater has worked on that and has grants on that and is showing some really nice results in terms of reducing stress. And so we think across the country, you know, not knee-jerking your way into opiates and finding other ways is probably a nice step as well.
I'm thinking if a mom is dealing with addictions, she's dealing with other problems as well and maybe not taking as good enough care for herself and her baby.
Right. So if you look at the cost, overall cost, if just fiscally, we would agree with that, you know, although it's $1 billion cost for the baby, think of all the costs that are associated with a mom that's not really functioning well. And some of them look very functional, but there's always a challenge and they have to take time out to take their methadone and all that. And so anything we can do to get them back in society, is fiscally and emotionally in every way beneficial.
And I'm thinking about these infants we were talking about when we first began about, so let's say after about a month, hopefully the opioids are out of their system and then they can develop normally?
Yeah, they can. And we teach the moms how to be better parents. And there's a lot that goes on to that, obviously. And they're often single and they're challenged at home fiscally and all that. So there's a lot of work to do, social workers, et cetera. That's some of where the cost is. But it's worth it because at the end of the day, this baby could have 100 years of life and hopefully productive life ahead.
Anything else? We're almost out of time here, but anything else that people should know about? I mean, this is such a serious issue.
Well, thanks for bringing it up. I think we're seeing it in the pediatric circles, and it's something that we think attention. You know, it's probably a 10% medical issue, but there's 90% that we can do from other aspects. That's really important.
Well, we really appreciate you coming in and talking to us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Jay Greenspan, professor and chairman at Nemours Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. He's a pediatrician in chief there. He's also chair of the March of Dimes Maternal and Child Health Committee for Pennsylvania, talking about the fact that the number of babies born addicted to opioids in Pennsylvania has increased dramatically in the last 15 years. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.